Clubhouse.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home with your hosts, Beth Kushnick and Caroline Daly.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home. This is Caroline. Hey, Beth.
Hi, Caroline.
Anyone who's watching TV or movies knows that the industry has been rocked in recent years by strikes, by decreasing budgets, by jobs going overseas, to say nothing of an actual global pandemic. Beth, can you believe it?
It's true, Caroline. In fact, May 1st marks the one-year anniversary of the start of the Writers Guild of America strike. The WGA strike and the subsequent and prolonged Screen Actors Guild strike, together with other factors you just mentioned, have all contributed to what is being called the Great Contraction in the film and television business.
We all hear about celebrities and how they're coping during these times, but there are many untold stories of collateral damage. All the behind the scenes or below the line workers, as they're called, and third party vendors that are suffering from this great contraction. We think it's really important to talk about those stories. And Beth, I'm so glad that you have some people for us to talk to.
Well, it's been a tough year for all of us, and because it is important to tell these stories, we've decided to pull back the curtain and talk about the state of the industry in this week's episode of Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home.
Beth, it may seem obvious, but why do you think that listeners should care about these collateral damage stories?
Well, for me, the below-the-line crew and the vendors make it possible for me to do my job. I'm one of those people. It makes it possible for everyone to do their job. Without them, there would be no TV shows or movies. And when a production shuts down, there's a real ripple effect. You know, when so much is affected by productions shutting down, moving away, entire economies can collapse. Businesses really thrive when a production shoots on location in a neighborhood. Our listeners might not think about it, but from the local florist to the dry cleaner, the corner deli, people not in the industry rely on the industry to make money and support their families. And in the last few years, many businesses all over the country have taken a hit that they cannot recover from. The same is true for crew, who just cannot continue to survive these prolonged work stoppages.
Let's get into it, Beth. Let's talk about this week's guest, RJ Rappaport. RJ owns RJR Props, a production facility and prop house in Atlanta, Georgia. And when we pitched this episode, what made you think of RJ as the right guest to have on?
RJ was the exact kind of guest we needed to tell this collateral damage story. RJ relies on production for his business, you know, and so do his workers, and his workers' livelihoods depend on a strong and robust TV and film industry. He provided great insight as to what's happening in the current industry, because not only does he own a prop house, but he owns a stage and books it frequently until the Great Contraction for film and TV shows.
So we know this is not our usual, typical, lighthearted, advice-driven look behind the velvet curtain, but we also know, listeners, that you're going to appreciate this take on the state of the industry. It's an aspect that not enough people are talking about. And now Beth and producer Mike's interview with RJ Rappaport, owner of RJR Props.
Joining us today is the owner and founder of RJR Props, RJ Rappaport. RJ, thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Having a great day.
So glad you're with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Beth.
We love having people that Beth know come on the podcast and talk about their experiences. But today is going to be an interesting focus because, as we said in the intro, people who are listening, we're talking about kind of the state of the industry and some of the stories that maybe you don't hear otherwise. So let's start with you, RJ, and let's start about your beginnings. I think RJR Props started in 1991. That's what my research told me. And since then, you've kind of become a fixture in the Atlanta film business, or the RJR Props and studio house has. Talk to us about your beginnings. What made you get into the business? How does one even start a prop house? Do you just start buying fake money and guns? Where, how does that even work?
It's a great story. Thanks. We've been in the industry for about 17 years. Just to give you a background, we have about 30,000 props, everything under the sun, everything from full-sized airplanes, a Delta airliner, 757, Gulfstream G5, not one, but two real New York City subway trains, just on and on and on. We have standing sets. A standing set would be where they could come in and film. So if they needed, say, a full-size hospital, they could come in and film, and it's set up ready to go. We also have about 30,000 props. Props are considered smaller things. So if somebody needed to, let's say, do a period piece where you were going to do 1945 and you needed antique radios, television cameras, an I Love Lucy type of show where, or just an old TV show and you wanted to recreate this, we've got the working studio cameras here, the television studio cameras. We have the equipment, the headsets, the lights, everything to make that happen. Or if somebody wanted to make a modern military, we have the guns and the military equipment, et cetera, et cetera. Been an interesting journey. Been doing it for about 17 years now, and no 2 days are ever the same.
17 years, so you kind of predate, though, the rise of Atlanta as what some people call like Hollywood South. What was the impetus for it? What was it? Did you love movies and television? You're like, I want to have my own ER set that I can just hang out on? Or was there a need there that you saw rising and you wanted to fill?
I could try to take credit for it, but honestly, it's a blessing from God. I can't take any credit. I didn't expect it. I never planned on getting into it. My background was, I was going to be a doctor when I grew up, and nobody told me. It's very bloody. It's very icky. So I changed majors and got into computer science after I had a pre-med degree. And so I ended up working in with servers, basically selling large servers and electronic gear to the military and large corporations. And I did that for many years. And we were watching a downturn about 17 years ago. And I said to myself, well, these giants, you know, 6 foot tall or 7 foot tall servers are not really selling anymore to the military. Not sure what we're going to do. And I prayed one day and said, you know, please God help. I don't know what to do. I'm not sure what direction to take my life. And interestingly, a couple of days later, I get a phone call. And a fellow called me up and he said, young man, I need a very specialized piece of equipment and I'm sure you don't have it. And I said, well, try me. He said, it's called an enunciator panel. And I said, say no further. I've got it. And he said, it's a $30,000 item. You know what an enunciator panel is? I said, I do. He said, how in the world do you have one? I said, it's a long story, but you want to come down? Sure enough, he comes down. And just so you and I know what it is, if you've ever gone into a high-rise building in Manhattan or any of the big cities, and you're on the lobby floor, you'll see a panel on the wall somewhere that nobody ever notices. But that panel is usually a few feet tall by 1 foot wide or 2 feet wide, and it has indicator lights, and it tells the health of the building. So if there was a fire on the 12th floor, that might be flashing. It would be number 12, and it would say fire, and it would be flashing, and an alarm would be going off. Very rare item. He comes over, and I said, let me show it to you. Here it is. And he said, I do not know how you have this, but this is amazing. He said, that's a $30,000 incredibly rare item. I need it. And I said, sure. He said, I need this thing to light up, and it needs to be installed in a movie set by 7:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. And I said, sure. Do you want me to put lights above it, below it, or to have the internal lights light up? And he said, you know how to do that? And I said, yeah, perfect. And he says, you can do that? I said, yeah, just common sense. He said, it's not common sense. And I said, well, been doing electronic repair for many years. So we lit it up. And he said, this is incredible. Let me buy that right now. And he said to me, young man, you don't know who I am, but you just saved my butt because I need this on a movie set tomorrow morning. He said, my name is Bob Shelley, and I'm one of the premier special effects people in the world. I own Bob Shelley Special Effects, and you helped save my rear end. I'm going to help get you into television and film. And my answer to him was, thank God and thank you. And he said, hold on, you thank God before you thanked me. And I said, yeah. And he said, I like that. And I said, thanks. He said, I'm a very devout person. And I said, I am as well. And he said, we're going to get along great. And that was the beginning of a very long friendship. And from there, something interesting happened. About 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Turner Broadcasting, and they said, we're making a new movie, and we were told that we have to use you for props. And I said, okay. And they said, have you ever worked in television and film before? I said, nope. And they said, oh gosh, we need the following sci-fi things. Do you think you could provide them? And I said, yeah, I'll try not to blow anything up along the way. And they said, oh gosh, don't say that.
Fantastic.
And that was it. That was a new door opening in of blessings in my life. And thank God it all went well. And we've had a great run for the past 17 years. We say what we're going to do. We do what we say. And it's always, we love the challenge. We love the technical challenges.
Because no 2 days are ever the same.
Ever.
Beth, how did you get to know RJ? I actually don't know that story.
I don't know. We just knew of each other. And, you know, way before RJ Props, I did a series of jobs in Macon and Atlanta. And those were really the days when the South hadn't become the film mecca that it is. But throughout my whole career, I don't think people realize that it's a relatively small group of us that do this in the art department, the subject department, even our vendors, especially on the East Coast. And we all know each other. And we've been communicating more recently about the state of the industry. And I just thought he would be a perfect person to join us.
I do have to say, I'm very biased towards Beth. She's very lovable.
We think so, too. That's why we've been doing this for so long with her. So, and she's a wealth of knowledge. I mean, I think one of my favorite parts about doing this, usually I'm behind the microphone and, you know, just listening. And I'm always impressed by the recall that Beth has and that her guests have. And there's a certain stamp of approval without even speaking to you, RJ. You know, Beth says we have to have him on. He's a good guy. I'm like, I'm already sold. That's the kind of Beth track record that she has. But again, I mean, an annunciator panel, 17, you know, that's so random. And I love that. I love that story. That's just being in the right place at the right time and being open to what's ever going to come.
And always saying yes. We touch on that in many podcasts for anyone who wants to learn. That is a way to make yourself invaluable. Just be positive and take it on. And that's what's going on, I think, in this pivoting, reinventing yourself time.
I mean, let's fast forward, because 2020, COVID hits, the industry slows down to nothing. Eventually, it starts to open up again, maybe not as robust. And then 2023, first we have the Writers Guild strike, and then we have the Screen Actors Guild strike in July. They've been over now for months, but we're not really seeing the work come back, the business come back. Everything seems still very sluggish. Why hasn't the work come back? This is for both of you. I'm curious what both of your impressions are, because you're in two different parts of the country, so I think you each have probably your own experience. But RJ, you first. Why do you think the work hasn't really come back in force yet this year?
I think there's a few things going on. I think it's almost like a triple strike against the industry. I think first, COVID shut us down terribly. We were down a year and 3 months with COVID, and it was pretty horrifying. It started out when Tom Hanks and his wife got this terrible new illness, and that's when the film industry realized, right in the middle of production, that this is a deadly disease. And it was in the beginning with that first strain that came out. There were millions of people that died, and anyone over the age of 60 or 70 was really in grave danger because they didn't have medications. They had nothing. So the entire industry shut down and sealed, literally sealed. I'll just share a quick story with you. So there was a particular major, major, major feature film. I'm not going to say which one. They were in the middle of filming when COVID hit, just right near the end of it, and they were just about to wrap. And apparently what they said to the folks is they said, set your things down in an orderly manner, head out to the parking lot, start up your cars, go home, and we'll call you. Everybody from the welders to the actors, to the lighting guys, to the sound guys, to the grips. Everyone just literally set their stuff down. Now, my company was called in the middle of COVID, and we were told this feature film has shut down. And they're paying rent now for 8 months on this building. And everything was just literally set down as it was. It's going to be freaky when you walk in there. Do you want to go in there and see what you want to buy? Because we need to shut down this building and we need to have everything out in exactly 2 weeks. We're paying rent on a gigantic building that we don't need. And we don't know how much longer this is going on. So this was like 8 months into it. Wow. We walked in. There were lunches on the table that were fuzzy. There were drinks that were exactly where they were. Everything was frozen in time. But COVID was the first big hit. And then with the writer's strike and the actor's strike, it was two more. And then really, you could even think of it as a fourth wave, which is what we're in right now. So the actor's strike's over, the writer's strike's over, and where are we? We're still in Never Never Land. We are not working. You can ask anyone in television film from California all the way to the East Coast, from the South to the North. Everyone's in the same boat. So right now in Georgia, we normally have roughly 125 to 135 productions going on simultaneously. I think we have six.
Yeah, the numbers are incredible. The change in numbers. It's the same thing in New York.
Yeah. So if you think about this, if you ask somebody, just for argument's sake, and you say, hey, you're making $100,000 a year, you're living in Manhattan, you're living in L.A., wherever you're living, can you go down to $6,000 a year?
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
No.
Can you grasp that? But this is what's happening.
Yeah, this is the plight of the collateral damage. You know, the SAG strike and writer strike had a lot of support of working actors and writers at the highest level, and they raised a lot of money to support crew and take care of their writers and their actors. Unfortunately, they got good deals because they held out for what they wanted, and they just haven't gone back to work either. But the collateral damage of the behind-the-scenes people, there were no resources for us. You know, imagine if you're just out of film school and starting up, or if you're in the middle of your career and trying to raise a family, almost at the end of your career and still not ready to retire. It's sort of been a forced work stoppage for everybody. And, you know, you hear a million different things, from driving for Uber to picking up DoorDash to leaving the business altogether. It was one thing when it was the writer's strike and the SAG strike, and everyone sort of made it through that all in the hopes that it not only was going to come back, but it was going to be the floodgates opening and there was going to be so much work that we wouldn't be able to handle it all. But it's really a combination of a lot of things. A lot of production is being done overseas, and a lot of people at the executive level are being fired. And post the strikes, everyone's sort of analyzing all different kinds of projects. A lot of them are being canceled. And it's really a quadruple whammy. You know, it's just all these reasons put together has just slowed everything down to being almost non-existent.
So we see this phrase, the Great Contraction. Is this what we're talking about when we hear that, when we read it in articles? Is it not just that it was on hold, but that it's actually shrunk in a maybe permanent way, or at least currently permanent way?
I think we're all, I think, inherently positive people. We try to be. We have made the decision to enter this business, and takes a certain person to be a lifetime freelancer. But I think this is a change for good, you know, similarly to the Great Depression. I mean, it is certainly being noted everywhere from the executive level on down to interns. I mean, it's just across the boards, the work has stopped.
RJ, I mean, in addition to your 30,000 props, you also rent stage space, right? You said if people want to come use your hospital set, they want to come use one of your plane sets, if they just want to film on a soundstage, that's a part of your business. I imagine that's also been affected. It's not just people not getting props, but also not renting space. How has that affected your overall business? And is there any pivot there? Is it something you can convert, or how are you managing that two-pronged kind of assault on your business?
So it's not an easy thing at all. There's millions and millions of people coast to coast that are affected by this. I don't know anyone that's not affected in the film industry. And it also, by the way, I'm going to answer your question about the stages in a sec, but it has a much bigger effect. And it actually even hits the economy, the U.S. economy. Just in Georgia alone, the film industry is a $6 billion, with a B, $6 billion a year industry. That's very, very, we're talking very large numbers. In Georgia alone, there's about 100,000 people that are affected. Coast to coast, it's millions and millions of people that are affected. And it's all the spin-off businesses, the people that would provide the catering, and the people who are part-time electricians, both in the film industry and in, you know, working as a regular electrician or carpenters or construction guys or whatever. This affects the country. And I agree with Beth. Well, I agree with Beth and everything. I adore Beth. So I agree with Beth that this is going to be long term. It may be permanent. But there's a dark side to this that I wanted to just touch on for a sec. We had COVID, actor strike, writer strike, and now it's another strike. And that strike is the rerun hit that we're taking. I think the studios realized at some point that instead of making new content, they could just keep running blockbuster reruns over and over and over. I can't tell you how many times Harry Potter has been on, but I think Harry Potter's been on, you know, it's 1,000th rerun. Every time I come home, if I flick through the channels, there's Harry Potter, and there's, I came home the other night, my wife was watching Dory, you know, the little fish Dory. And I said, "That, dear, that's Dory." And she said, "It's a little entertainment." And I said, "Yeah, I know, but it's like 15 years old." And she said, "There's nothing else on. There's this. It's just all reruns." The studios, I think, are realizing that if they just run reruns, they don't have to make new content. But of course, there's a very, very big danger with that. The danger is it's going to hurt the studios very, very badly, and they don't realize this. Studios, the big studios, are going to take, I think, a pretty substantial hit, because people only watch reruns for so long, and then they get disgusted. And they say, "There's nothing in the theaters. There's nothing on television. There's no new content. I'm turning off the television. I'm done." And they start to move on to other things in their life, not counting on the studios for entertainment. I think we're going to see that now, and we're starting to see it already, where people are just tired of watching game shows or, you know,
reality shows.
Although I was just going to say reality shows.
I just saw Card Shark 2019 being put back into the primetime schedule again, and I just shake my head. I mean, I grew up loving Card Shark as much as the next, you know, kid in the 80s, but what are we doing in 2019? There's so much, you know, scripted television out there. Why? It infuriates me.
But it also has, like, other elements. There's, of course, the AI element. There is the situation now where they're talking about the Great Contraction, including the positive for studios in literally holding a completed film or TV series, or even canceling it without it being aired and taking it as a loss, being more financially beneficial to the studio. And I think they're, you know, in that sense, really giving up on the audience, because they feel like this is primarily an audience that'll be happy watching YouTube and other platforms and getting littler doses. You know, the business has changed, the model has changed to a series being 6 episodes or 8 episodes. All of these damages to the industry as a whole, I think it's just finally caught up, all of them, with each other and with the threat of AI. And the human aspect of it is really not being captured.
I agree totally with Beth. And I think there's one very dark element that I don't think the studios are realizing, the very, very long-term dark element that's behind all of this, and that is we're going to lose the greatest people this industry has. We are losing the greatest entertainment industries now. We're watching this great exodus where people are leaving the industry, and it's happening. So producers are going. And we're talking very experienced people, people who you can't afford to lose, someone who is so exceptional at what they do, who says, you know what, I'm done. I don't need this. I'm going to retire. Or younger people who are exceptional, and they are getting into real estate, and they're getting into other fields. I know a number of people in television and film that are now real estate agents, and they said, I'm done. I can't do this. I have a family. This is the dark side of it that's happening, and if you lose an entire generation of great filmmakers, you can't recover. That takes a decade or two decades. You know, it takes years of experience, or you might not recover, you know?
It's so true, because this generation that you're talking about, what's still left is the combo of the new generation and the old generation. And we do our jobs in two completely different ways. You know, I talk about all the time about what it was like to be a set decorator before my cell phone, before computers. And to have this generation of workers who've experienced both that and the new way of doing things, you know, having a podcast, having Instagram, you know, having access to my fan base coming out from behind the scenes, which was never a part of the old way, is like the perfect blend. And it really does contribute a lot to the business. And that's going to be gone.
I mean, I don't think anyone has a good sense of what the business is really going to look like, say, fast forward 2 years, 3 years. I mean, we're not through all of the union and guilds renegotiating their contracts. We are not through the dark times, I don't think, in any way, shape, or form. So it's scary. It's a scary proposition to think about what it is going to look like in a couple of years. What I mean, just based on what it looks like now, which brings me back to, and I want to circle back to you, RJ, especially with the rental space, that's a lot of space. It's a business. How are you pivoting? What would you say to others who come to you and say, I don't know what to do, Rich. I what am I supposed to do here? What's the pivot? How do you go about doing that?
So what we ended up doing was I said to myself, I can't count on television and film. So it's almost like heresy to say that, isn't it, Beth?
Yes, you know, it is.
It is, but I can't count on television and film. So I need to do something else. So we've tried to diversify into as many other things as we can just to have income coming in. So we've tried to do anything. We have a lot of little specialty niche areas that we focused on, but everything is competitive. And whenever you think of something new, you know, like I feel like some days I'll just lie there at night looking up at the ceiling, not able to fall asleep, saying, I got to come up with another new idea before I fall asleep. And I'll come up with a new idea and we'll put it into play. And then a week later, somebody will say, oh, hey, RJ, I saw that you're doing this. That's such a great idea. We're doing it too now. It's okay. Oh, okay. So it doesn't matter what you do. You just have to keep coming up with new ideas and shifting. And I think we're all hoping and praying that it's going to come back. And it's going to come back strong, but we don't know.
I think there's a certain reality that's set in. You know, when the first strike started, it was, you know, let's get through the summer. And even then, for really the first time in my career, I remember hearing so many people say, hey, this isn't such a bad thing to have the summer off with my kids. I've never, ever experienced that. Even when I was working on 22 episodes a year, my months off were May and June. So I never really had that time off with my daughter. And people were so sure that everything was going to come back in the fall. But I think all these months later, there's been a sort of recognition and everyone's changing what they feel is their reality. And that's why so many people are making these decisions to pivot completely. I have done everything from staging to set decorating for events, interior design, open my Amazon store, every way in which I can think of. And, you know, what I talk about the most with my friends who are in this situation is they miss the structure to their life. You know, being a freelancer is hard enough, but when you're on a movie or a commercial or a TV show, you have a work schedule and life and structure. It may be 12 to 16 hours a day, but you still have that. And I think keeping everybody's goals in focus has been one of the most difficult things that people are experiencing. And, you know, amongst crew, people are sharing their sadness and trials and tribulations, which of course helps everyone. But it really has gone, I think, unrecognized. You know, people talk about how hard it is to explain to their family, you know, that the work has just evaporated.
We have the luxury, I guess, or the pleasure to speak to so many people in the industry. It's not only with you, Beth, and people in the industry, but in the other podcasts that we cover here at Pod Clubhouse. And you hear people talking about, we're recording this in early April. Pilot season has come and gone, and it was just a graveyard for so many that really rely on that time to really get going. It used to be a pop culture event. We'd be coming into upfront soon, and it's just crickets. It's really, I mean, Rich, you described going into that warehouse that was just shut down 8 months earlier and it being eerie with like the fuzzy food. The whole thing feels like that, though. It all feels like a little bit of a horror movie. I was raised by television. I was raised by pop culture. And it's been an adjustment for me just being on this side of it. I can't even really imagine what you guys who are on the front lines, who rely on the industry in a third party way, the collateral damage, that phrase that we've been using. Beth, you've mentioned before giving advice to people who are maybe just starting out, you said in passing, and I know you've recently used some interns on a couple of jobs. What kind of advice would you give or are you giving to those who are in film school or just graduating and trying to get started? Maybe they're electricians or they're carpenters or they're designers or hairstylists, whatever. There's so many below the line jobs that are being affected by this. What's the advice for those people? You guys have been in the business for years. What's the advice for the new people who are just starting out?
All the below the line jobs. I mean, I preface all of my requests by students and, you know, people who reach out to me with, I'm not meaning to be a Debbie Downer, but I'm going to give you a realistic viewpoint. And, you know, a lot of graduates of film school and would have a hard enough time just getting into the business if it was booming, because it is something you have to really commit to. And here they've committed to their college education, a lot of money, a lot of time. I think the students who have diversified and maybe have a degree in film but studied business, this is certainly the time to shift your focus. If the business is going to go the way of AI or computer graphics or a similar field, but something that has longevity, I certainly would recommend that. I don't see anyone, if they just continue to wait until the film business restores, I highly recommend that that's not something they do. You know, so at this point, it's sort of almost like getting your own degree in all different aspects of life, all things that could help you in the film business. You know, knowledge about a lot of things plays an important role. So I think any job at this point is something good. Usually, you know, work begets work. And I think there's still going to be enough time that we have to wait this out, that just being employed is a positive.
Diversify, you know, starting, you know, diversify your toolbox of skills.
Yes, you know. Exactly.
How about you, RJ? If I'm sure you have people who are coming to you or coming through your business looking for advice, what's your go-to if you have?
So I agree completely with Beth. I've been actually telling people the same thing. I teach some specialty classes with SCAD a few times a year, and I've had interns here that we've brought on, and I've just been trying to give the same advice. Don't depend on television and film, because I don't know when it's going to be there, if it's going to be there. You have to have, just like what Beth said, Beth, you and I are on the same wavelength. I said to these students, you know, if you're going to be studying film, get a business degree along with it, because at least it'll teach you the secrets of being successful in any business, not just film. So if you needed to shift and get into a similar related industry, such as music or who knows, events or whatever it's going to be, you can still be doing things that are interesting and closely related. You may not just be focused on television and film, and you just can't be right now because it's just not there. I'm hopeful and that it will come back. Can AI take over everything? I really don't think so. You can try to have the most realistic AI characters that you want. It's insanely expensive. Yes, the price is going to come down. You know, trying to say the lines and trying to convey human emotion, I don't know. I suppose if you have an unending budget, you could probably do it. But I'm thinking, unless they have some magic sauce that comes out, they're going to need human beings for a long time in the foreseeable future. There's just no way around it. They are making feature films overseas, so we know that it's happening. And you can't make everything overseas, nor would you want to make everything overseas. So I think it's certainly going to be here. When it's coming back, I think is the answer lies in when the audience gets so fed up with the studios putting on show after show after show that are just scripted reality shows or ridiculously predictable shows or game shows, where the audience just finally kicks back and says, I'm turning off the set. And they see.
Yeah, the studios have to see that, you know. So right. People have to use their power and their financial power in terms of streaming and use their voices. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we really wanted to do this particular subject, not to be negative, but it was so interested this week in a story I read about people of all the different aspects of cast and crew. It's really the actors who might get a boost from things being shot with AI. Any actor who can perform well with a green screen or with AI created background is going to be an asset. And I thought, wow, that's really giving them something to focus on. You could really educate yourself to become someone who's proficient with acting with no one.
Right. Tennis ball acting.
Yeah. But that can end up being an asset.
Yeah. No, I mean, we talk about it. We were having a conversation before recorded a couple of days ago, Beth. We were talking about how AI is we're not fans of it, but it's also this necessary evil almost where you're going to need to work with it, at least for now, until it's either run its course or has taken over everything, you know, one way or another. It's either going to become our overlord or it will pass out like a fad. So, RJ, you actually hit on a great segue to the next conversation. Production in the U.S. versus production overseas. I wanted to talk a little bit about tax incentives because Atlanta and New York, two places where you guys are located, are so driven by tax incentives from those municipalities to production companies. Are you still seeing them having an impact? Are they still working, keeping productions in the U.S., or are you seeing more and more work go overseas? I think there's always been work overseas, but are you seeing a fleeing of work to go overseas?
I've seen really large productions go overseas, not for the entire, a few of them for the entire show, but most of them for parts of the production where they'll go overseas. Regarding the incentives are critically important. They are essential. How do I walk on these eggshells? Whenever we bring up incentives, there's politics that go hand in hand. So there's always going to be a few people that think, well, we're giving away too much. And there's always going to be a few people that think we're giving away too little. And there's always going to be some folks that think it's just a good balance. Recently, we had a few politicians in Georgia that were concerned about the level. There's one particular model that unfortunately circulates every now and then that was created by a particular individual who doesn't like the film industry, doesn't want the film industry here. And that individual, he made a model showing that too much is being given away in the state. He goes around to the politicians and tries to influence them, saying, look at how much is being given away. But when independent analysis has been put on that model, it shows that his data was flawed and that it's really quite inaccurate. And recently, there were a number of politicians that listened to this individual and said, wow, we're giving away too much. We need to cut incentives and make it much more complex for the industry and much more difficult for the industry to get those incentives. And thank God it was stopped, because if you make it very complex for the industry to get the incentives, they don't want to deal with that. They don't want to jump through the hoops that you're putting them through. Instead, they just say, forget it, let's go to another state. That's something that nobody wants to deal with here. We don't need to lose more jobs. We need to have more jobs coming here.
Yeah, the states are sort of in a bit of a competition with each other to keep production in the United States. You know, which state pays the incentives quickest? Who has the most money to give? You know, I've worked in this business before the tax incentives, and now there's a lot of negativity about the tax incentives. It is a part of the budgeting and the reason why a job is done in certain states. But on the whole, we're seeing really good results in foreign countries. I mean, there are movies being made about U.S. history in Romania, you know, so there are talented crews, and all you got to do is go to Prague or Romania for 6 months or 8 months. The actors get waivers to work there. The crews are local. So it's just a lot of competition for a small piece of the pie. You know, just the numbers have changed so dramatically. But tax incentives will always be a really political and controversial issue. But one thing I encourage everybody to remember is this is basically a clean industry. Years ago, I worked on the tax incentives in New York. You know, what I learned were not only is it a clean industry, but it has an amazing ripple effect. You know, when just a commercial is shooting in a neighborhood in Manhattan or somewhere in Brooklyn, everything, the dry cleaners makes money. The corner deli makes money. The restaurants make money. You know, it has a very quick cash infusion into a neighborhood. And that's really important.
It's one of those things where it's just another thing that I think people sitting on their couch watching a show
don't think about.
They don't think about. And it's funny, too, because and Georgia comes to mind because they have the logo of the peach. If you watch credits all the way to the very end, usually the very last, second to last title screen on the scroll is this production benefited from tax incentives, usually from either Montreal, you see a lot of times, or from Georgia. And people don't realize what's going into to make your productions happen. Georgia, though, is so interesting, though, because I think one of the things that contributed to the rise of Atlanta and Georgia in general, and I think about this from The Walking Dead, was it was able to stand in for so many different places in the country. If you just drove a few miles in each direction, you can kind of have all of the climates and all of the looks that you needed. You can't easily replicate that in Romania or in other states necessarily.
Well, you'd be surprised at how many looks they have.
No, hold on.
But
Hold on, we're talking Romani. No. We have everything. We have the mountain. We got the lake. We got the road, big road.
One of my first jobs in Georgia was creating Vietnam on Vietnam War Story, the first HBO series done. We created rice paddies, and I worked with the local unemployment labor force to plant 200 dozen plastic rice sprouts and flood a field. And we literally created rice paddies and shot dirt roads and dressed them like Vietnam in Georgia.
I'm laughing over here, Beth, because I can picture you doing this. We've all done these crazy things. Yep. We've all done these crazy things.
But you know why it worked? Because there was a military base and there were Vietnamese people available, and it all came together. The weather and the different places that we could shoot. And this was all before Georgia was popular. I did a Civil War movie there, you know, where local people were lending me their antiques, you know, that were registered with the National Trust. I mean, it was the best place to work at in those days, especially when it was sort of a new thing that movies were being made there.
If I could jump in. So nowadays here in Georgia, things have developed to the point where it's shocking how much infrastructure there is in film. Absolutely shocking. So there's levels and levels and levels of depth and experience. And I fear that it's going to be lost. So we have more studios than you could possibly imagine. So just one particular studio up in Norcross, I think it's 1 million square feet, if I'm not mistaken. It's massive. They filmed Hunger Games and quite a few other large ones up there. Many of the Fast and Furious series have been filmed there, as well as a lot of the big sci-fi superhero movies. But the infrastructure is so tremendous. So there's thousands of places with camera equipment, sound equipment, lighting equipment, just every different possible aspect of the film industry. And it wasn't that way 20 years ago, for sure. But experts have come here from many parts of the country. Just here for us, for instance, at my place, we've got, if you needed to make a fake elevator, for instance, we have an entire room full of elevator panels, and they all work. You press the up button, it lights. You press the down button, it lights. We have thousands of industrial props, for instance, or if somebody needed a helicopter, we have two. For computer servers, I think we have 85 computer servers that all light up. They all work. They all look proper. In the gun room, I think we've got 500 or 600 weapons. None of them shoot anything. There's blank guns and there's replica guns, etc. But there's just so much depth here now, and it's changed so much over time. I just hope that this is not going to be lost. I hope that the studios realize, yeah, the game shows are enjoyable, and yeah, the scripted reality stuff is sort of kind of entertaining, but you got to have real features. You got to have real content. And I hope they wake up and realize this. Otherwise, they're going to lose tremendous amounts in advertising because people are just going to be turning off. And I think they already are starting at this point.
Well, it's been a really serious episode for us, probably in 5 seasons of Decorating the Set, From Hollywood to Your Home, our most serious episode, but very important one, timely one. And we're so glad that you could join us. Thank you so much, RJ.
My pleasure. It's been delightful as always. And thank you guys so much. And to the audience, thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed.
RJ, before we let you go, if people wanted to, you have a website or a place where people could find more about RJ Props online?
It's so nice of you. Thanks. It's rjrprops.com. And if you're on Facebook, just look for RJR Props. And you'll see just so much. If somebody wants to make a music video, we have thousands of music video props, or a sci-fi. If somebody's a student, we have student discounts, and we try to help everyone. No matter what budget you're on, we try to help everybody. So I appreciate that.
These days, that counts for a lot.
The website really is voluminous. I was lost in there for a good while yesterday. There's a lot on there. So,
and a lot of behind-the-scenes things. If you go to our Facebook page, RGR Props, you'll see lots of behind-the-scenes things. There's a new movie that's filming with us right now, a feature film. They've rented our sets for about 10 days, so they got our whole building. I'm going to be putting up some behind-the-scenes footage of what's going on there this afternoon, so I hope everyone enjoys that as well.
That's amazing. RJ, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been eye-opening, and I'm really glad we got to have you on. I hope down the road we can have you on again for, you know, happier times. maybe we do a field trip to Atlanta and we go visit you.
Oh, you're going to get a hug. Beth's going to get a hug. And I hope you guys like chocolate caramels, because I always keep chocolate caramels in this office ready for guests.
I am a big chocolate caramels fan. So listeners, head over to rjrprops.com and check them out on Facebook at rjrprops and see all RJR Props has to offer. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll check you out next week.
Although this is a different and somewhat difficult subject to cover, I'd like to thank RJ for joining us and telling the crew and vendor side of what's happening. We'll continue to give you updates, and hopefully the industry will start to recover, because we want our listeners to keep enjoying and watching television shows and movies, and we all want our livelihoods to continue. You can always contact me with any questions or inquiries through my website, www.bethkushnick.com.
And if you are in the industry or a vendor being affected by the Great Contraction, please reach out to us. We want to hear your story. That's going to do it for this episode, listeners. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home at Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please leave a 5-star review. It helps a lot in promotion of the show. 5 stars, people. Thanks so much for listening.
Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home is an original Pod Clubhouse production, recorded, edited, and produced at Pod Clubhouse Studios. For more information, please visit us online at podclubhouse.com. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.